Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, everyone. Happy Shabbat to one and all. We're here with Kirk. We might have JB later in the program. I don't know. He may also be out today. But we do have Kirk with us. And Kirk, I think we need to return before we begin our review of the Assyrian. To the announcement that was made yesterday, might have been the day before now, by Donald Trump regarding Jerusalem being the capital of Israel, and the response by the nincompoops who call themselves Muslims.
Okay.
We talked in the observations program that, well, it was absolutely the right thing to do to identify Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It reminded Trump's announcement reminded me of what happened once Jerry Falwell had read Tea with Terrorists, and he announced on the Today Show that Muhammad was a terrorist, but didn't have a working knowledge of the Quran or Hadith, and therefore was ill-prepared to prove the point and to validate the point, or even to talk about why the point was relevant. And all the points relevant because, well, Muhammad was a terrorist. He led 75 terrorist raids in the first 10 years of the Islamic era. In each of those raids, they were for the purpose of armed robbery, where his belligerents, armed to the teeth, attacked civilians for the purpose of stealing their property, raping the women, enslaving the children, and murdering the men.
Did
he did 75 times, over the first 10 years of the Islamic era. And the Islamic God routinely announces that he is a terrorist. Muhammad even said, "I have been victorious with terror." And so when you recognize that, then you'd say that, okay, Islam is a terrorist manifesto. It's a criminal enterprise. There's no denying that. But Falwell did more harm than good and later backtracked on his statement because he was ill-prepared to make it.
Mm-hmm.
True statement needed to be said, but not unless you're prepared. It's why I tell people all the time, don't go off and tell your friends about what you've learned about Yahweh until you've studied a couple of years. So you're prepared to answer questions so that you understand and can internalize the choice that you've made,
mm-hmm.
and are prepared to present it and in a way that where if you're asked a question, you can answer it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good.
It's just like Trump announcing that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. His only justification was, well, you know, not announcing it hasn't helped the peace process over the last 30 or 40 years, so why should we continue the same old practice?
No.
Well, that's not the reason.
No, it's not the reason. The argument.
Right. The three things he failed to say is that, first, the only history that exists on Jerusalem, the only history that is known to the world, there is absolutely no knowledge of Jerusalem whatsoever, its founding as a city, apart from what's told in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. None. You won't find a speck of history on Jerusalem, even of Israel, apart from what's in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And so, in there, we learn that it was Dod who captured the city from a from some Jebusites, mm-hmm. a group of people that no longer exist, and that he built his home there and fortified the ridgeline of Moriah in the center of Jerusalem and developed springs there and bought the threshing floor that was available from Abruzzi, Jebusite. And he, all of that, the terraces, all of it not only is detailed in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms with the people who were involved, those they wrestled and tussled with during the time, those they allied with, the other people who lived in the general vicinity, what they were like, but also very detailed descriptions of precisely what was built there.
Mm-hmm.
And through archaeology, we have found that everything, from Yahweh's name to Dod's name to the timing of it to Dod's home, Dod being David,
mm-hmm.
to the threshing floor that was turned into the Temple Mount, to the top of Moriah where Abraham and Yishak met with Yahweh as a dress rehearsal for the first Pesach and mm-hmm. to affirm the covenant. All of it is historically available to verify Yahweh's account. And that account goes back, it starts 4,000 years ago with Abraham and Yishak.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3,000 years ago, it is affirmed through Yahweh and his beloved son, Dod. And there is no denying that everything Yahweh said and is recorded about the city is verified in the archaeological digs.
Right.
And there is no other claim to it. It's a 3,000-year-old or 4,000-year-old claim if you go back to Abraham. It's a 4,000-year-old claim or a 3,000-year-old claim if you're dealing with Dod and the descendants of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And since Yahweh proves, Islam claims that the Quran was inspired, or the Torah was inspired. That speaks vociferously of this place. And Christianity claims that the Torah is inspired by God. It speaks vociferously of this place, as do the writings and the prophets, all of which is proven through prophecy that it was actually inspired by the creator of the universe. And it's undeniable what it says. It's proven, irrefutable. And there are no other claims. You know, Alexander the Great didn't conquer Jerusalem, claim it on behalf of the Greeks.
That's right.
You know, Rome conquered the entire region and set up shop in Jerusalem. But even when they were set up shop in Jerusalem, what did they call the province?
Jerusalem.
No, they called the province Yehuda.
Oh, you mean when they changed the name?
The Roman province was called Yehuda from the time that they conquered they took over the Greek assets in Egypt. And then everything in between. And when they did, that province was called Yehuda. And Yehuda, Jerusalem, was the capital of Yehuda. And there was no dispute over that. There's never been a dispute over it. So that's the first thing you should have said, is that the archaeological proof. And the proof from the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms is irrefutable that it belongs to and is the capital of Yisrael and Yehuda. And there is no other claim to have founded that city or that city to be the capital of any other kingdom. You know, when the Romans or the Greeks came to control the entire region after Alexander divided the world amongst his four generals after his death, they divided it after his death. That wasn't, Jerusalem wasn't the capital of any Greek empire. When the Romans came to control it after they defeated the Greeks, Jerusalem was the capital of Yehuda, not of anything that part of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
When the Byzantines took it from, inherited what the Romans had conquered, it was the province of Yehuda. It wasn't the capital of Byzantinia. It was Constantinople.
Right.
You know, when the Muslims began to fight the Byzantines, and they came to control the world, particularly the first 100 years after Muhammad's death, where they were the most butcherous, violent, deadliest cult in human history, percentage of the people that they killed. All they did with Jerusalem is the Muslims did the same thing they want to do with New York. They want to, build a mosque as a trophy to say, hey, we did this.
Yeah.
They wanted to build the ultimate Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater than Yahweh, to build a dome to Satan right there on the Temple Mount after the Romans had torn it down and built a shrine to Jupiter. If you look at and the Muslims didn't claim it was the capital of anything. No, the Muslim capital is Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And even when the Muslims had the first caliphate after the fall of the rulers in Mecca, in Arabia.
It was Damascus, wasn't it?
It was Damascus. Yeah, it was Damascus for hundreds of years. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not Jerusalem.
No. Nobody wanted it.
Nobody wanted it. You know, it had the Muslim trophy there, but that was it. Now, the reason for the Muslim trophy, this is the thing that when you see Muslims protest and say, this is our red line, they're violent, they're vile, they're screaming, their women are screaming, their men are screaming, they're burning things, they're killing people. To protest Jerusalem is to say, I am so stupid that I can't think that you ought not pay any attention to me because I'm an absolute moron. Because the claim on Jerusalem is that Muhammad, while he was engaged as a pedophile and over 50 years old and having sex with a six-year-old girl, baby, claims that he rode a winged ass from Mecca in the middle of the night to Jerusalem. Now, asses don't fly. You can't get from Mecca to Jerusalem during the night. It's called the night's journey. Moreover, he claimed that he immediately went into the temple. Well, the temple had been destroyed for over 500 years. And to not know that, and to not know, therefore, that the Quran is an absolute lie and Muhammad's claims are dishonest, you're an idiot. You're just not thinking. You've been conditioned not to think. And then, of course, the first thing that Muhammad claims to have done with a winged ass is go up to meet with Allah, but he can't get directly from Allah. The first step along the way to Allah is hell.
Sure.
Where he claims that he saw women occupying hell, being hung by their breasts with meat cleavers because they are meat hooks,
because
they didn't properly they weren't properly appreciative of their husbands. the whole thing is such a disgusting story, from the being a 50-year-old man and having sex with a 6-year-old girl, to claiming to have flown on a winged ass overnight, to claiming to have gone into a building that hadn't existed for over 500 years, to claiming to go to meet Allah by first going through hell, by saying that about the inhabitants of hell. The whole story is so despicable, so obviously demonic.
Made up.
Yeah. Made up, perverted. That to claim it on behalf of your religion is to say, my religion is so stupid, it would only fool an idiot. And yet, nobody in the media will take the time to read the story. What does the Quran say? What does the Hadith say? How stupid is that? And that's all they would have to do to recognize there is no legitimacy here. All this does is prove that Islam is a complete and utter fraud. And then, of course, they want to claim it as a on behalf of the Palestinian people. When was the last Philistine?
When was the last mention of the Philistine?
Yeah. Yeah, when the Assyrians left town. Around 720 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been a Philistine since 720 BCE. And, of course, there's no record of the Philistines apart from what Yahweh has to say about them prior to 720 BCE.
They build about the same as a Muslim.
Nothing. Yeah, so you're, once again, you're back to the fact that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are precisely accurate, easily proven, and an archaeologically valid, and it presents the story of the Philistines. Yeah, the people now call the Palestinians. It presents that case. And it says they were nothing but barbarians and invading terrorists, and that they were annihilated by the Assyrians. And they left nothing as a record. No memorial, no buildings, no cities, just some unattested and unremarkable graves.
Mm-hmm.
Signs that some people died. And they're only known even then to be Philistine graves because they're in the location where the Torah prophets said, Philistines were there. They're uncivilized, barbarians. And if the Torah is not true, which that's impossible because Yahweh was testimony so easily verified, then mm-hmm. the people never existed. If it's not true. If it is true, then they have no claim on anything. They don't have a claim on land. They don't have a claim on God. They've got no claim to anything, and they don't exist. And so to claim that that there is a country called Palestine and that there's a Palestinian people and that they have rights and that the Jews are occupying their land, again, you are so stupid. You ought to be embarrassed. You just ought to be embarrassed. It's amazing that people can be so ignorant, so irrational, and so passionate about their utter stupidity. But that's what we're witnessing around the world. And Trump needed to make that point. And didn't. Mm-hmm. And the last point he didn't make that really upsets me is to, when the whole world said, hey, by announcing this, he's going to cause an uprising of violence in the Islamic world. All he had to say is that if you disagree with this, then use evidence and reason to demonstrate that the conclusions on archaeology and on history are invalid. And if you can't do that, then just shut up. And if you're going to respond by shouting and screaming and burning and looting and killing, then all you're going to do is prove that you were never worthy of any negotiation or of any benefit of any negotiation because you can't be trusted. So if your response is going to be as we expect, which is to be violent and vile, then you're just proving that there is no such thing as a two-state solution, that you're not deserving of anything, and that just as America has committed that it will not negotiate with terrorists, we will not negotiate with people who act this way, ever.
So if the New York Times tomorrow were to go to press with what you just discussed, with his history, What would happen? I know probably nothing, but I mean, there would be more informed people. You'd have an argument. I mean,
So
that would conclude if that can't happen or won't happen. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to not let you answer.
Yeah, you can't argue with it. There is absolutely no way ever to demonstrate that anything I've said is incorrect or that that there's another way of looking at it. There just isn't.
Yeah.
This is as black and white as anything could possibly be. So the answer to your question is as follows.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people read the New York Times.
Well, I just
and those who receive the New York Times are far more interested in things other than front page news. Would publishing it be the right thing to do? Yes. Is there anybody with the New York Times that is willing to do that, since it flies in the face of political correctness, where you have to be incorrect to make your case? No, there isn't anybody that would be willing to do it. So it's a hypothetical that has no chance of being fulfilled. And this is the biggest problem in the world today. 100% of those who are religious are incapable of being rational. So you could present all the evidence in the world to the fundamentalist Christian or the fundamentalist Muslim, and you have a 0% chance of prevailing. You can prove to a Muslim that Muhammad admitted that he was demon-possessed and prove that the entire basis of Islam is a complete and utter fraud, and that 99% of terrorist acts worldwide are perpetrated by Muslims because Muhammad was a terrorist. Mm-hmm. And there isn't one in 100,000 Muslims process any of that factual information. The same thing would be true with Christians. You know, you can go through and say, God cannot die, so God cannot die for your sins. There's no benefit and no example of bodily resurrection. That the Trinity is a Babylonian concept, and that Paul admitted to being demon-possessed, and that Paul is contradicting God in every possible way, and therefore cannot have been truthful. And you can prove all that to them. Prove to them that everything Yahweh says prophetically about the last days is about reconciling his relationship with Yisrael and Yahudah, and that there is nothing that he says ever about a church. He doesn't have a church. And you can prove that to them. They can't process it. So the answer to the question is, hypothetically, it would never be done because it isn't politically correct to tell the truth, ever. That's why it's called.
Well, that leaves us with only two choices left.
And if somebody did, the 99.999% of the people in the world, because they are either religious or political, and political people have the same thing. They react. They can't think anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Less than one in maybe 100,000 people could process the information.
Yeah. Well, it leaves us with either a hopeless state, if you were trying to correct people, and the second is you just couldn't.
It's the situation. You know, I think the situation is worse now than it was when Yosha was last here. Worse than when Dode tried to communicate with people worse than when Yashaya was conveying Yahweh's words or Yirmiyah.
Yeah. At least they knew their own history
always,
to some degree, and they knew Hebrew, so he wasn't talking.
Yeah, I think Yahweh's always been in a situation that he was in with Noach, that he was in with Abraham. He was in, for the most part, with Dode. That he was in with Yashaya, Isaiah, that he was in with Yirmiyah. Which is that in a world of people, anywhere from 1 to 10 may have known him, had thought their way to him, handfuls of people. And that's just the reality of it, is that it's very, very small numbers. Yahweh says when he reconciles his relationship with Yisrael and Yahudah, in the end that a young child will be able to count the number.
Mm.
That's how small it will be.
Yes. I've read it, but it's still, wow.
Yes. So we're in a situation where it has always been the case that even people speaking directly for God, whether it's Yoshe or Yeshaya or Dod, that the overwhelming preponderance of people are not swayed by Yahweh's testimony. They just aren't. They don't care.
Well,
they claim to worship God, and they reject. In fact, they not only do reject, they dislike his testimony.
They hate his testimony.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
sure.
Full-blown hate.
Yeah. Correct.
No, you're
not a Christian. This is what God said, and you know, they just go immediately to their Pauline New Testament. In fact, if you even tell them what Yoshe said, particularly as it recorded in Matanyah, they hate that too.
And then they quote Paul.
Yeah, they can't figure out why that's stupid. So the answer to your question is the reason the world is in such a mess is that we're back to the time of Noah, where Yahweh twice said the problem is that people are satisfied with, and they are swimming in a swamp of malignant lies. And as a result, they're violent and they're repulsive. So we are where we have been for a very long time in terms of humankind, for at least the last 5,000 years. Not much has changed.
Yeah.
I think it's also why, you know, if I told you today that as I was translating Yeshaya 11, the 11th chapter of Isaiah, that I came upon two more references to the neck, the banner that Yahweh specifically says he's going to lift up in the last days. And the reason that it's singular, again, is because there's just so few people that know Yahweh, that care about it, that pay attention to it. That's why it's singular. And in this, in the 11th chapter, one of the two references is that just before Yahweh says, I'm going to remove my people from all of these places around the world, he lifts up this banner so that his people know why he's doing it, who he is and why he's doing it, when he's going to do it, so that they're responsive, because to be a Israelite outside of Israel will be a death sentence. And so he's going to bring his people home. And so he's raising this banner, this sign once again, so that his people know that they're being called home. Now, I don't know if there's any place in the world other than what we're doing where that is being discussed. Then the next time he mentions it, he says that the banner is being lifted on behalf of his family, but it's also going to serve as notice to the Gentile nations that I'm removing my children, and that anybody who tries to oppose me will be severed and banished and be cut down. You know, God's not fooling around. And so it serves as notice to the Gentile nation. But one of the references there in Yeshaya 11 actually says that that while the message is on behalf of Yahweh's family, that there will be Gentiles who pay attention to it and will come to adore, become passionate about Yahweh's home.
Now, is that during the tribulation or prior to at least the last 3.5 years of the tribulation?
What we know for sure is that it occurs prior to his Yom Kippurim return, Day of Reconciliations. And by the way, he doubles down on Kippurim, which is the plural of reconciles, such reconciliations, by saying there's a dual reconciliation taking place at the time of his return. Yisrael and Yehuda are reconciled with one another, and then both are reconciled unto Yahweh. That's why it's reconciliations, plural. Now, which completely screws the Christian church at that point. Ain't no room for Christianity. Right. So, the banner is clearly lifted up in advance of Yahweh calling his people home, which is obviously in advance of his return. The sense when you read it is that this is something that we should expect to be happening now. And Israel will pay more and more attention to it as things become more and more dire. So the sense is the banner is being lifted up right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are the banner.
Oh, absolutely.
And that, more and more Israelites will be paying attention to it. Just as a side benefit, a number of Goyim will find Yahweh's home as a result. Well, God's clear, that's not the purpose of it.
Yeah.
That is a consequence of it.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, Goyim find Yahweh and his home and come to revere him and his home. And in the but in the long term, the purpose is to alert Israel and Yehuda that God's coming for them, and they need to follow him back home. That he's going to provide a means for them to come back home, and it's important that they do it. And that this banner is going to explain that, and at the same time, the banner is going to warn the Gentile nations that if you try to interrupt anything that I'm doing in this process, the consequences are going to be severe. This is not a good time to oppose me and what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's marvelous stuff. We promised we were going to do, Kirk, and I wanted to interject this interlude, though, with
the
myth of the Palestinian people, which is an absolute myth, disgusting myth, myth of Muslim control over Jerusalem, and that it's not the capital of the Israeli state, and there's the whole sympathy with and antipathy against Israel and sympathy with Muslims. It's just so repulsive to see it transpiring worldwide and to see no one holding them accountable. No one.
Well, let me ask you one last thing about that situation. Uh-huh. Is the reason, is it just to stir up the Middle East? I mean, there's somebody behind Trump. I don't think Trump's got enough brains to, you know, he's just all about himself. So I don't.
Well, he is all about himself.
But is there somebody in the government that CIA or whoever?
No.
Wants to stir up the Middle East more and encouraged him to do this?
Yeah, listen, Trump's announcement is a correct announcement. He just didn't do it in the correct way.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequence of it, when you do the right thing but in the wrong way, the consequence is almost always bad.
Sure.
And so I think that by doing it, he ignited this. The fuse has been ignited for a long time, but poured more gasoline on the bomb that's ultimately going to explode. I mean, we're told that the world is ultimately going to galvanize against Israel, that mm-hmm. they're going to force Israel to give up the West Bank, as they've already given up control of Gaza. That will turn the nation to 10 to 15 miles wide at its waist. We're told specifically that's what's going to happen, where it's going to happen, when it's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, the country will become indefensible, and that Yahweh's only living messengers at that time, covenant family members, will be withdrawn.
Yeah.
Israel will be on their own, and it's and Muslims are going to flood into Israel as jihadists to kill every Jew and wipe the country off the face of the earth in a tsunami of terror. That's what we're told is going to happen. That's going to happen, folks, in 10 years, the decade.
Yeah.
So, this kind of an announcement made the wrong way. Makes that inevitable. That's what it does.
Yeah.
Inevitable. You know, because Muslims were, the protests were in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Pakistan, in Turkey, throughout the Islamic world, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Every place burning American flags, down with America, killing, we're going to kill Trump, we're going to kill Netanyahu, we're going to kill Jews, you know, that America is the ultimate terrorist. It's, it makes the prophecies that God has predicted inevitable. Now, what's interesting in the 11th chapter, you asked me on the observation show, because it says specifically that as a result of Yahweh bringing his people home and him reconciling his relationship with them, that Israel is going to fly aircraft in to eliminate the Palestinians. Calls it out by name. Says Palestinians are going to be bombed by the aircraft are going to swoop down against them, and that as a result they're going to be destroyed. And you asked me if it's on the west or the east, and I said east. It's actually both. The first reference is on the west, which would be Gaza, mm-hmm. and the next reference is on the east, and then it names the territories in the east that they're going to control, all of which were part of God's gift of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So on both sides of the, Gaza on the west and across from the
other side, close to Jordan.
The Dead Sea, the Sea of Galilee, and the Jordan River on the east, anywhere from 50 to 100 miles on the other side.
Now, would that be close to the time when the tsunami finally hits, when they squeeze it to
work? Well,
could that be, that could be any time now to then, I would assume.
Yeah.
Is it more specific than that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We're in a period probably now of 5.5 years, maybe less than that, probably in a period of,
about
4 years from, we've got to be at least a year into the tribulation, and mm-hmm. we have to be at least a year from the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're constraining the time that this can happen. The last battle, of course, is Armageddon.
Yes,
which is a rendezvous in the Valley of Megiddon by people who come from the east.
Mm-hmm.
And long before that, the Magog War has been fought and
lost. And
it's over. Fought and lost, so it's over. So it has to be a part of the Magog War, not Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Armageddon is not fought by Jews, not fought by Israel. Armageddon is 100% Yahweh who opposes and Armageddon. And Yahweh plays a major role in the conclusion of the Magog War. So, I would say that we're looking at the conclusion, the start of it, probably 11 years from now. And by the way, I think it's like all things today. It's already mm-hmm. begun.
Oh yeah,
It's already
groundwork.
The order of things are that Damascus will become a heap of rubble. It's going to become like Homs, like Aleppo, like Mosul, like Fallujah. All of those places now are just nothing but heaps of rubble. They've been completely and totally destroyed, and so Damascus is going to become a heap of rubble. Syria is going to fall as a nation. And then the world is going to constrain Israel at the waist, forcing them to give up the what's called the West Bank, giving it to the Muslim terrorists. And then they're going to, within months of that time, there's going to be a tsunami of terror coming into to Israel. So I think that we're looking at this continuing to escalate, coming to a crescendo in about 11 years.
Well, I tell you, 3 years ago, I had a problem believing that Damascus wouldn't fall by now. I mean, it was just, it seemed like so inevitable. It's amazing how, Yahweh's timing is always Yahweh's timing. If you say it's always looks so bleak.
Yeah, we had thought that it was inevitable that it would fall because you had so many forces in opposition. Yeah, you had the United States and Europe in opposition to Assad, and then all of these terrorists who, the Islamic State and al-Nusra, that were fighting against Assad. And the Iranians at the time were broken on the ropes because of all of the sanctions.
Sanctions,
but,
right.
You know, but things changed. One is they were given all their money back. They were able to sell their oil on the world market. The Iranians were given Iraq. They came to control Damascus and much of Syria. They came to control Lebanon, reshaped the Middle East, and the Russians and the Chinese came to support Assad and the Iranians. And so you created a new dynamic that made the fight more prone to erupt into World War III, which is what's going to happen. And the belligerents are now staged for World War III. At the same time, you delayed the fall of Damascus. It would have already fallen had that not materialized, particularly the Russians had not come to Assad's aid. It would have already fallen. The fact that they did, and the fact that the United States decided to arm the Kurds and now is already betrayed the Kurds. Now the United States got what they wanted out of the Kurds. They've already betrayed the Kurds, and they will betray them further because Turkey is a NATO member, so they will betray them further and let Turkey have their way with them. As a result, Damascus stands. Now it's not going to stand for any more than another 10 to 11 years. 10 or 11 years from now, Damascus will be a heap of ruins. That is the triggering point for all the rest of this stuff. The harvest, true harvest of covenant members occurs right after that. The Torahless One comes onto the scene immediately after that. And then the Muslim world arms itself and prepares itself for the ultimate assault into Israel, and they're stopped only by God. So that is what we're going to witness. And I'm telling you, looking at the utter stupidity of religious people and political people, people who are overtly political, people who are overtly patriotic, people who are overtly religious, good riddance.
Yeah.
God, this notion that God wants to save everybody and everybody is God's children. Oh, good. Not only God I'd want to spend any time with. People are repulsive.
No, you carry on a higher scale then. It'd be worse.
Right. You want to spend your eternity with nincompoops? I mean, somebody stupid enough to believe
that
Jerusalem somehow
is
a Muslim place? No, I don't want to spend my eternity with the kind of people that are protesting around the world. Hey, you hear that the Pope announced that he's going to reinterpret the Lord's Prayer.
Lord's Prayer?
There's a Lord's Prayer. Yeah, there's no Lord's Prayer. But he wants to interpret it because he said, you know, right now it says, and lead us not into temptation. And he says, you know, God doesn't tempt. So it should say, you know, help us avoid temptation.
Mm-hmm. From falling into temptation.
Okay.
Well, you know, Jesus said that in Aramaic, so you should pay attention.
He actually didn't. He said it in Hebrew.
I know, but the Pope said he was in Aramaic.
No,
he wouldn't dare
say
he said it in Hebrew.
Yeah, I know.
It was translated then, of course, into Greek. And then
into Greek. Hebrew to Greek, Greek to Latin, Latin to English, and of course, edited and changed and twisted along the way. And, of course, the Yahweh never asked anyone to pray. So
no.
It's just the whole thing. And public prayer is anathema to God.
Yeah. Well, at that point, you know, also you have to ask yourself the question, if you could pray, would Yahusha be able to say that prayer?
Yeah. Of course, that the
forgive us my sins, but he didn't have any at that point, so nothing was free.
At the same time, what the Pope forgot to mention is a part of what was going on, is that at the same time in the Archdiocese of New York, the Roman Catholic Church paid out $40 million the same day that the Pope says, you know, we don't want to say lead us not into temptation. They paid out $40 million to sex abuse victims.
I did not know that.
Yeah, New York Catholic Church pays $40 million to sex abuse victims. Just over $40 million in compensation has been paid to 189 people who identified themselves as victims of clergy sex abuse, the Archdiocese of New York said in a report released on Thursday. And what the average payout was if you were sexually abused by a priest, your gift from the Roman Catholic Church is $211,600. Stunning, huh?
Yeah.
Of the 1.5 billion Catholics, they're just going to say, you know, enough's enough. No more of this.
Well, let me ask you another question. You know, in the same week, this past week, they announced there's a big slush fund in Congress for paying off the same thing for all these politicians.
Correct.
And I'm going, and why isn't everybody fired? I mean, I'd like to shut the whole thing down and take our chances. But regardless, I mean, nobody.
Oh, they're falling like flies too in Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, every day it's another one.
Yeah. Good. Go to jail for most, please.
Yeah. That was one of the reasons I was wondering why Congress wouldn't take away from the military their ability to try sexual abuse cases in house. And why didn't just turn it over to the civil courts?
Civil courts,
in the military, a woman was 800% more likely to be sexually abused than an American citizen would be outside of the U.S. military. So, you know, you're 800% more likely to be abused in the U.S. military than outside of it. And your perpetrator, the perpetrator of the crime, has only a 1% chance of being punished in the military. And the victim of the crime is guaranteed to be further abused by the chain of command. And I wonder, why didn't Congress do something about this? This is, you know, they want everybody to worship the military, and the military is the most egregious abuser of women in the country, even worse than the Roman Catholic Church. Well, now we know the reason. They're too busy abusing women on their own.
So you should never ask the question, why does Yahweh want to wipe all this out?
Oh, of course.
Especially after last week's going over just a snippet of history.
Yahweh is really, really tolerant when it comes to sexual infidelity and sexual promiscuity. I mean, look at Dode. He loved Dode. And Dode had more wives than he could count.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to keep track of, certainly. That's not Yahweh's pet peeve. I know Christians have a conniption fit over it because the homosexual that they worship, known as Paul, wrote all sorts of bad things about it. But the fact is, you know, Yahweh's pretty tolerant when it comes to sex. He doesn't want incest. He's disgusted by incest, disgusted by bestiality, and doesn't have much care for homosexuality. But he has very little to say about sexual relations between parties that is with mutual consent. And so, but what the congressmen and senators are doing is sexual abuse. There is no consent.
No, it's a power trip, absolutely.
That's a power trip. Yeah, that's a power trip, and it's disgusting. It's just all the rest of it. It's a disgusting power trip.
Well,
so let's turn to...
He says a lot of things about the next four things you're going to talk about in just a second, about what he does hate. And
what he does hate. And there are a lot of things he hates, and sexual promiscuity is not high on the list. He's going to speak about an Assyrian, and the Assyrian is Satan. He says, "Woe to the Assyrian, the rod, staff, scepter, and spear, the Shabbat of my disappointment and frustration. The nations mean to project its influence in their hands is an expression of my righteous indignation." God is telling us here is that he created Satan. He created Satan as a tool. That from God's point of view, a malach, of which Satan is an implement. Now, I've got some heat for saying that a number of times, but that's the fact of the matter. He is saying that Hasatan, the Assyrian, is an implement. He's a rod, which is an instrument of economic oppression. A staff, which is the tool of religious oppression. A scepter, which is the implement of political oppression. And a spear, the tool of military oppression. He's saying that the Assyrian is an implement, it's a tool. And God created Satan, and he created evil, because there had to be a filter. What would the purpose be of a heaven if everybody was there? If there was no filter, if there was
we already have that, don't we?
Yeah, we already have that. It's called.
We don't need to create anything new. You don't need a heaven for that.
Turn on the news. It's pretty screwed up. So there had to be an alternative, and Satan is the tool that Yahweh created to provide that alternative. It's a stupid alternative. And it's nothing but an implement. But he's equating the Assyrian, who is Satan, to a rod, a staff, a scepter, and a spear, the implements of oppression. And he's going to use that to try to get the attention of his children, of Yisrael. You know, when if you have a child and that child is making really dumb decisions, they're hanging out with the wrong people, they're doing things that are counterproductive, that are certain to destroy their character, shorten their lives, devalue their lives, you've got to do something. I mean, as a parent, you just can't say, "Oh, well, I just love them to death, and who really cares?" That's not Yahweh's approach. So he decided he was going to use Hasatan as the Assyrian as an implement. And he wanted to express his righteous indignation against his people. So we shared that passage at the end of a program last week, and we read the next one. "As a godless Gentile individual and or nation, I will allow him or it to stray, thereby be in opposition to the family, causing my intense displeasure." So what this is conveying is that Israel is God's home, but just as the Garden of Eden was the place where God resided with man, he had to allow Satan to come in. You know, when people say, "I can't believe that God would allow anyone to corrupt his word." What do you think the whole story of Satan slithering into the garden is telling you? How did he get in? With Yahweh's permission, he got in. God let him in, and the first thing he did is corrupt Yahweh's testimony. He's, once again, allowing the Hasatan, the Assyrian, into his home, into Israel, to perform this particular function. And so it's important to understand that Satan has limitations. God can limit what he can and cannot do to his children. But in this case, his children were so wayward that it was time for him to get their attention. So he was going to allow Satan into their home. "I authorized him to do as he desired." Now, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
This is Sawahu, but written in the Peel Imperfect Jusuf, which means that God wasn't, at this point, Well, God can incarcerate Hasatan if he wanted to, then the tool no longer has any value. But
yeah, that's right.
He is not controlling Hasatan. So Hasatan wants to do this. He wants to inflict harm on Yahweh's chosen. So he's allowing Hasatan to do as he wants. But because these are his children and his land, he still requires Yahweh's authorization to, otherwise he'd be prohibited from doing so. That's why, you know, as a member of the covenant, Hasatan can't influence you. God would prohibit it. There's no reason for him to allow Satan to touch you.
Thank you.
So I allowed him to do as he desired, which was to plunder his prey. Now, plunder means you steal their possessions.
Mm-hmm.
And to carry off that which is valuable, which he had stolen from those who would conquer and loot, and to set himself over them, trampling them down as if they were mud, malleable clay, swampy sludge in their public places. Yahweh uses the term the swamp. You know, I use that metaphor to say that
the
Christian New Testament, is so corrupt. Mm-hmm. It's like analyzing a reptilian discharge in a swamp.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh uses the reference of swamp and slimy all the time. And at this point, his people had become slime. And so he wasn't going to go in there and clean them up. He was going to allow Hasatan.
They need to carry away what they want.
Right. And, you know, and maybe what he's saying is, after you've had some time with the adversary, you know,
maybe
you want to come back home.
Yeah.
See how you like this. You like socialist secular humanism? I have a little time in one of Hitler's camps. Tell me how much you like it. Now, in our program last week, we went through and we actually listed about 20 examples of this kind of behavior. We'll skip over that now. Here's the next statement. This is Isaiah 10:7. But he does not, however, intend to perish. In his heart and from his perspective, he does not consider that it will play out as such. Indeed, from his perspective, it is his desire to destroy, decimating and exterminating everyone else, and to cut down and disassociate not a few Gentiles and nations, but many.
One he can get hold to, yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
is
he delusional, or is he just wired that way? What do you think?
I don't want to pretend that you know I have an understanding of an energy based being that can transition across the seven dimensions, and that I have the capacity to understand all of this and the words to describe it. But I certainly have thought about it, and I certainly don't have any issue with sharing my conclusions along the way, just so long as you recognize that we're limited. And then every time that I try to create an example to say this is something that might help us understand this, every example has its flaws. Okay? So, first of all, a Moloch, of which Hasatan the Assyrian is a living being without a soul. Without a physical body, they're an energy-based, light-based, living being. They were not given a nesama. They were not given a nefesh soul. They are immortal. They can transition, go anywhere in the universe, from Yahweh's home in the seventh dimension all the way down to where we are and get wherever they want to be instantaneously. They're not omnipresent. They're not omniscient. And they their power is limited. I view them as a tool. If the closest analog that I've come up with is that we're now experimenting with artificial intelligence,
yes.
And we're experimenting with robots. If we were to create an energy based form of artificial intelligence
mm-hmm.
that could go anywhere at any time and unrestricted by physical form. That could still influence people around him by way of this artificial intelligence, where there is a programming flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And that that it was programmed to do one thing, to be benevolent and to advance, you know, human culture. And it has a programming flaw, and it's number one ambition now for this artificial intelligence, smarter than any human, is to control, to lord over, and ultimately destroy mankind, because mankind is a threat to pull the plug. And comes to despise this artificial intelligence, comes to despise its creator, try to undermine what the creator has done, despise life with a nesama and a soul. And so it's a form of artificial life, if you will, energy-based, that has a flaw in its programming, a virus in its programming. So it's just it's something that was created that has gone amok. And I think it was programmed with the ability to go offline like this, given the ability to go offline. Because of the value that it serves.
I think that makes a lot of sense. The fact that he has known Osama, because there are people actually out there that think that somehow Satan could change his mind and repent or some kind of thing, the way they think. And I'm going,
no,
are you insane?
No. Oh, yeah.
Can get all this he's a throwaway.
But that's the whole thing, like the Roy Moore thing, where the Nimrod Christians in Alabama said, you know, if my Lord has forgiven him, if my Lord has forgiven him, then I'm going to forgive him too. And people forgiving those that murder their children, and yeah, come on, wake up. No, it's absurd. So, no, he is not going. First of all, there's no such thing as repenting.
No such concept.
Hasatan,
no way to get back.
His future is that in 15, 16 years.
Yes.
He is going to be sent, he and every fallen Moloch is going to be sent to Sheol.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be locked up in Sheol for 1,000 years. And just as Hasatan was allowed into the garden, Hasatan and his demons, fallen Moloch, are going to be allowed into the very last days of the millennial Shabbat. Before the earth is destroyed,
for the same reason that he was allowed to be.
Exactly the same reason. There will be mortals born during that period of time, and they need to be confronted with a real choice.
Yeah, Chawa.
Just like Chawa. So that's exactly what's going to happen. And then immediately thereafter, Hasatan and his fallen Moloch are locked up in what is the equivalent of a black hole for all time. And those who leagued with them will be put in that same black hole, where time is eternal, but nothing escapes. And so that is their fate. But now, what we read here is that, and I hope those who are listening are not frustrated that we're, you know, talking here about the Assyrian and trying to understand Satan, but I think it's important for, particularly for Yehudim, to understand who Satan is and what his goals and ambitions have always been, how he operates, where he is restricted, because being forewarned in this case is exceedingly important, especially at a time, and I want to reemphasize this. While I'm happy that you and I and those who are listening and reading these books as Goyim benefit from what we're doing. But that isn't the purpose of what we're doing.
No.
The purpose of what we're doing.
Not the purpose
is
what Yahweh is doing.
Our purpose is Yahweh.
You can tag along.
Right. We become part of his family. We are grafted into Yisrael. And our message is for Yisrael. Now, Yisrael and Yahudah are going to endure the tribulation. During the tribulation on earth, guess who's going to be in charge?
Well, Hasatan.
You got it. The Assyrian, Hasatan, is going to be in charge of the earth during the tribulation. And therefore, it's extremely important that we take the time to warn Israelites about the nature of this individual, what he chooses to accomplish, how he operates, how he thinks, and what's ultimately going to happen to him, and what his position is relative to Yahweh. And that's particularly important because in Kabbalah, which is part and parcel of Rabbinic Judaism, in Kabbalah, the adversary, HaSatan, is an equal player along with Yahweh. And so they have been so misled by religious Judaism in terms of the nature of Satan that they need to hear this. So Yahweh is presenting this. This is part of the banner that he's lifting up. And so we're going to speak about who Satan is. And I even think it's fascinating for Goya members of his family. I think it's important for the more we learn, the more we understand, the more we enjoy our relationship with one another and with Yahweh.
Sure.
So it's helpful for us, but it's particularly beneficial for the intended audience. Okay, so what God is saying is that the Assyrian, Satan, doesn't expect, his intent isn't to be destroyed. He doesn't want to serve as a parable whose ruinous actions will eventually cease. That's not what he wants. He wants to prevail. He wants to ultimately triumph above above God. He wants to be worshipped as God. So he says, in his heart, from his perspective, he does not consider that it's going to play out this way. So, you want to know what his motivation is, what his thinking. He's not on the same page here as Yahweh. So you need to understand, if you want to understand who HaSatan's thinking, his thinking is he doesn't want to and will not accept the fact that it's going to play out this way. So God's going to tell us how it's going to play out, but don't expect HaSatan to agree.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that he doesn't agree because Yahweh's testimony is what will prevail. But it's important to know his mindset. He doesn't think that's going to happen. That's not what he wants. He doesn't want... Now, what he wants to do is to destroy, to decimate, to exterminate everyone else. Now, if he's of the mindset, that's what God is telling you. Satan is of the mindset that if he can destroy humankind, that he will somehow have prevailed, because that's where the rift with HaSatan occurred. He became jealous that man not only was given a nesama and therefore a conscience, the ability to judge, to exercise good judgment, to be responsible, to be accountable. The Malach do not have a nesama, and he's jealous of that. And he's also jealous of the fact that humankind, unlike the Malach, are given free will. And the free will of the Malach is extraordinarily limited. It's about the same, and maybe even less, than the free will of a private in the military when getting orders from a general. You can say no, so you have that limited free will, but the immediate consequences.
Wait for the blow.
See if you were really free to do so. Yeah, check your freedom immediately after telling the general to no, I'm not going to do that. So they have about that level of free will, and they were jealous about that, and also jealous that Yahweh, had this inferior being from their point of view, a lot less beautiful, a lot less shorter lived, obviously flawed, and Yahweh was so enamored with humankind and was willing to make so many sacrifices from humankind where he looked at the Malach as nothing but tools. You don't love a tool. I mean, you may have had a favorite paintbrush, but you just don't love it.
I'd buy another one and throw that one away.
Right, it's a tool.
Yeah.
But when your last dog passed away, that tugged at your heartstrings. You just can't buy another one of those. I mean, you can buy another dog. It's just that the soul that's departed, that's a loss. So, from his perspective, Satan's view is: if I can just destroy the thing that caused the animosity in the first place, humankind, I'll just destroy, decimate, and exterminate everyone else. Demolishing everything, annihilating others. And to cut down not a few Gentiles and nations, but many. The more, the better. That is his goal. For, he says, are not my commanders Sar Ani, my captains and officers, my princes and rulers, my soldiers and warriors, my religious and societal leaders, all together embodied with political, religious, and military authority. Now, that's really an interesting statement, because what Hasatan, the Assyrian, is saying here, the term Sar is a human term. It's positions, human positions of authority. And so the Malak that are under him have no authority. They're in a command and control structure.
Yeah,
there are no Malak. There are captains or officers or princes or rulers or soldiers or warriors or religious or politically. None of Malak, the demons under Satan, fit that category. So when he says, my commanders, my captains, my officers, my princes, my rulers, my soldiers, my warriors, my religious and societal leaders, he's talking about those he has influenced. He's talking about the world's religious leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They belong to Satan. That's what he's saying. They are mine. I control them. I influence them. My kings, my princes, my rulers, my generals, my clerics, they're mine. So he says they're embodied with political, religious, and military authority. I'm in control here. That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying he's in control because he is the influence in religion and in government and in societies and in the military. So you want to know how he operates? That's how he operates.
You know, it just occurred to me if that story is correct, where Hasatan offered everything to Yahusha, you know, do this and bow down to me. It must have really frosted him when he said, you know, I don't even want him. Why would he want them?
Why would I want them?
Don't do nothing to me. Keep them.
But here it is. Hasatan is claiming what he claimed in the discussion with Yahusha. Is that I own this joint.
Yeah.
I own it. The religious leaders, they're mine. The political leaders, they're mine. The military leaders, they're all mine.
Yeah.
And there is no other way to look at Sar. That's what Sar means. So Satan, because he is restricted by Yahweh, and because he can't be omnipresent, this is how he influences the world. Through political, religious, and military leaders. They belong to him. They are his. Now, and they are embodied with political, religious, and military authority. That's what Malek means. They're sovereign. They can do as they desire.
And do.
To prove the point, he says, this is fascinating, are not my commanders, my kings and dictators, my princes and political leaders, my captains of industry and military officers, and especially my religious and societal leaders, my Sar Ani, my government rulers and my soldiers and warriors, all together and completely embodied with political, religious, and military authority as the leaders of their nations and institutions, Malak, sovereign.
Hmm.
Hey, God couldn't be any more clear. If you're listening,
yes,
it's your government, it's your religion, it's your military. You want to find Satan, don't go to a seance. Don't go to an occultist meeting. Walk into the synagogue.
Go to a military parade.
Walk into the mosque. Walk into the church. Walk into Capitol, a building, government buildings. Walk into military installations. That is where you will find him. And he wasn't limited here. He wasn't saying, you know, aren't some of my... No, it's all of them. All of them. Is not, and then he lists a number of places. Kalno, translated Kalno. It's a Babylonian Assyrian city near Aleppo, which has now been destroyed. It means fortress of Anu, which is an Assyrian deity. Like Carchemish, which is the capital of the Hittite Empire, meaning Tower of Chemosh, Chemosh being their god. So, you know, it is isn't the fortress of the Assyrian god Anu just like the tower of the Hittite god Chemosh?
Mm-hmm.
Is not Chama, which is a fortress or walled city, similar to Arpad, which is means to base of support. So, aren't these two religious cities, the gods' names are different, but aren't they really the same, even though the
mm-hmm.
gods' names are different? These two places are fortresses that support a political government and a military. Are not they the same? Then he
mm-hmm.
says, is not Shimron, I'm sorry, the same as Damascus? Shimron means it was the Canaanite royal city. It's where the royalty of the Canaanites lived. It means dregs. Comparable to Damascus, which is means tears. It was the capital of Syria. These
mm-hmm.
are places where my royalty lived. Aren't these the same? And what's the difference between what's the difference between Russia and the United States? Is there any difference between the Vatican and Mecca?
No.
Yeah, the gods' names are different. But it's still me.
Mm-hmm.
The military report to different people. Still my military. What's God saying here? Yeah, it doesn't matter what they call me. It's all the same. As my hand discovered the governments of religious images and their representations of false gods, they could be compared with Jerusalem and compared with Shimon. This is really fascinating here. He's just gone off and said, listen, the capital cities where the royalty political elite lived, where the militaries were garrisoned, and where they worshipped gods, though the names are different, they're really the same.
Yeah, same stuff on the streets.
Right,
yeah.
And now he's saying, guess what else is same? As I went into the various governments, Malacca kingdoms and states, and all of these states were replete with these religious images, objects of worship. Pagan effigies, false gods.
Mm-hmm.
Their representation, he's saying, of false gods was comparable with what exists now in Jerusalem. It's comparable
mm-hmm.
with what's in Shamaron, which was the capital of the northern kingdom.
Yeah, northern.
He said, so, right? Come on, God.
Your people are
special, or your place is special. They're false gods. Are no better
yeah.
or no worse, no fewer,
huh?
no less prominent than any of the other places I went.
Yeah. Good point.
So he said, not only is there no way to distinguish between Russia and the United States, between Mecca and the Vatican, and between, Pearl Harbor and some other military base out there. Not only is there, Vladivostok. Now, there's
mm-hmm.
no way to distinguish between these things. There is no way to distinguish on the point that you care about the most, which is with the worship of false gods, the governments of the world, and the capitals of both the Northern Kingdom and of Yehuda. Oh, boy, does
mm-hmm.
that have to hurt.
Yeah.
Then the Assyrian, Satan, says, shouldn't I therefore do the same thing to Jerusalem and to her objects of worship that I have done with Shamaron and her religious images? I destroyed Shamaron.
Yeah.
But Jerusalem is no better. So what are you telling me, that you're going to restrict me to the northern kingdom, and I can have access to Shamaron in the northern kingdom, Ephraim, but you're going to protect Jerusalem? Why are you doing that? They're no better.
Yeah. Well, we know why, but he's
yeah, of course.
He's out of point.
But
the ocean's got to jump there.
It's important to know Satan's argument, Satan's mindset, and his argument.
Mm-hmm.
His argument is, it cuts right to the chase. Mm-hmm. And he's not stupid.
No.
That's an extraordinary, you know, if I was in his position, that's the argument that I would make.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't take it because I don't want to be.
No, don't say that.
But that is the argument.
Yeah. It's a valid point. He has a right to say, "Hey, wait a minute."
Yeah. Wait a minute.
What's the difference?
What's the difference? Yeah. Then it shall come to pass. Now, God's going to put Satan in his place, the Assyrian in his place, in a moment. Then it shall come to pass that my upright one. Now this is Yashaya is now speaking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Edom. My upright one will complete all of his work around the ridgeline of Zion and within Jerusalem. So, Yashaya has heard Hasatan the Assyrian make that argument, which is a valid argument.
Yes.
And Yashaya saying, "I know the answer, just like you said. You knew the answer."
You're just like me.
Yeah, we know the answer. He's got work to
we
do in
that.
Jerusalem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yashaya raises his hand and says, "Can I interject here, please?"
Yeah.
It shall come to pass that my upright one, the upright pillar of the tabernacle, is going to complete all of the work, all of his work, his ma'ashe, around the ridgeline of Zion and within Jerusalem. That's the answer. That's why.
Yeah.
That's why
like
you
that
can't
answer.
Have access.
Oh, there.
You can't have access. So Yashaya is saying, "I know the answer. Let me give this."
Ooh, me, call me, call on me.
Yeah.
I can do it.
Yeah. Then Yahweh speaks. I will hold accountable. This is so. Satan was a valid argument, but he's playing a losing game.
Yeah, okay.
He says, "Yeah." So this is now Yahweh speaking. He says, "I will hold accountable. I will summon and reckon. I will count, list, and record, and I will attribute the exceedingly conceited and self-aggrandizing attitude and judgment manifested by the dictatorial leader of Asher, of the Assyrian. Because I am in opposition to the haughty, self-willed, and unwarranted boastful look in his eyes." Yeah. Allahu Akbar!
Yeah.
Allah is greater than Yahweh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the bigger, wider, tough.
Saying,
yeah.
"I want to rise above the Most High. I want to be worshipped as God." And God is saying, that is so egregious, so exceedingly conceited, and so self-aggrandizing. That attitude, and by the way, it's dictatorial because he is Satan, after all, is the Lord. I'm going to hold him accountable for it. I think it's repulsive. And it's inappropriate. So, after I finish using him as a tool, it's over. Then he says, "For he says, by my might I have acted, and by my sage wisdom and superior intellect, because I know how to assess the situation, and I know what's happening, and I can deduce the proper response. I will therefore remove the territories and boundaries of the people. Whatever they had planned and prepared to accomplish, I will spoil, and I will steal. I descend upon and subjugate the inhabitants as if Almighty God." So there you are. That Satan, the reason that God is saying that he is going to hold Satan accountable is Satan says, "It's my doing. By my hand, I have acted. I've influenced these government rulers, the political rulers. I have inspired the religious leaders. I've inspired the generals. I've acted, and I'm on the ground. I'm doing it, man. I am here. I am engaged. I have." You see the movie The Devil's Advocate?
Oh yeah.
You ever watched that movie? Yeah, yeah.
He's
calling God an absentee landlord, you know. Mm-hmm. He says, "But I'm down here on the ground. I'm engaged. I'm the one who's, with man." It really mm-hmm. is exactly what Satan is saying here. Yeah, he says, "For indeed, by the might of my hand, you know, I'm the one that's acting. I'm the one that's engaged. And it's by my sage wisdom and my superior intellect. Because I know how to assess the situation. I understand what's happening. And I can deduce the proper response. Therefore, I'm removing the territories and boundaries. It doesn't matter if I am called Bel in one place and Baal in the other, the Lord in another, the Allah in one, Jesus in another, Dionysus, Bacchus, Zeus, Jupiter, it's all me. I'm going to remove those boundaries. I know how to play this. Whatever they had planned and prepared to accomplish, whatever mankind had desired, for example, ended up in heaven, being saved. I'm going to steal it from them. And he did. I descend upon and subjugate the inhabitants as if I were Almighty God. That's the Assyrian. That's Satan. He didn't say, I descend upon and subjugate the inhabitants as if I were the adversary, or because I am the adversary, or because I am Satan, because I'm a created Moloch. He wants to be known as, he wants to be worshipped as, he considers himself God,
yeah.
Almighty God, a beer. That is, that's why he is the God of Christianity, the God of Islam, the God of man, of socialist secular humanism. My hand has found and taken possession of what could be equated to the likeness of the nest. That's where children are born and raised, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Of the capabilities and the wealth of the people and the nations. As one gathers and removes eggs which have been neglected and abandoned all over the entire earth, I gathered and I removed them. I stole the children. And there did not exist a wing or appendage that even fluttered or fled. Anyone who so much as opened their mouth, not even a chirp, not even a twitter. That, when I read that, after having translated it, I was just floored. I mean, I was floored when I heard HaSatan here in Yeshaya 10 admit that he wants to be known and he views himself as Almighty God, because I didn't think that was going to occur until Yeshaya 14.
Mm-hmm.
But once that occurred, I said, my goodness, we are being given direct access to understand the mindset of Satan and how he operates. And then I just thought, what a treasure. I mean, what a valuable tool. What a wonderful gift. Such a huge benefit to know how he operates, so that you can see his fingerprints on religion, on government, and in military conquests. But when then he says this, I mean, this was just so profound. You know, my hand has found and taken possession of what could be equated to the nest. The nest is where children are conceived and raised.
Yeah, the home.
And I stole that from them. I stole their inheritance. I stole it from all the peoples and all of the nations. And just as one gathers and removes the eggs, the future generations, which the parents neglected, they abandoned all over the earth. I gathered and I removed them and not lifted a finger. Not even an appendage fluttered as I was doing this, and no one opened their mouth. Not a chirp, not a twitter. He acted as if he were God, and people worshipped him as God, and he stole their children. He stole the lives of their children. Robbed the nest. No one did anything to stop him.
No, we were all worship Sunday school.
Right.
As if it did not hold off the church.
It's the parents giving their children to him.
Yeah. Gave them to the Catholic Church. They gave them to the Protestant churches. They gave them to...
They walked out of the way and say, here, you can have them.
Now, summer's here. Let's go to Vacation Bible School. Learn some more about Jesus. God.
Yeah. I read that and I was just... My heart stopped. It is so indicative of the way that Satan acts, the way he works, and the way the mankind responds. And had Satan done any of this, overtly as Hasatan, as the adversary. Working on his own
merits.
100% rejection everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. But he never did. He always cloaked himself into whoever the god was, whether it was Allah or Jesus or Dionysus or Bacchus or Zeus or Athena or Astarte or the Lord or Bel. Didn't matter what the name was. He was always the god. Didn't matter what the country was. He was always the ruler. He was the inspiration behind the military, behind the government, behind the religion. And no one, because he came across as the authorized leaders of the world, the people that they were patriotic about, that they were proud of, the Muslims, you know, marching on behalf of Allah. Because of that approach, because he positioned himself, as he said, as Almighty God, no one lifted a finger to stop him. No one let out a peep. And, you know, I will tell you, Kirk, I've read a lot. You've searched a lot on the Internet. We have to, as part of the mission that we're engaged in.
Yes.
Have you ever read anyone who has recognized, put up their hand and say, wait a minute, Satan is not to be found in a satanic ceremony. He is not to be found. He's embarrassed by them. He is not to be found in anything associated with the occult. Satan is the god of every religion.
Yeah.
He is the government. He is the military. He is the religion that Christians and Muslims and rabbinic Jews have replaced Yahweh with Satan. And that is the Lord. The Lord of religion is the adversary. And that's where you'll find him. Have you found anyone else who has made that?
No, because, you know, when I was a Christian, I didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, the baby being the church or whatever. And now is throw the whole damn thing away. I mean, when he says walk away, he means walk away. There's nothing there to salvage.
Yeah. There's nothing to salvage. No, you're talking about an appendage of Satan. He claims, and he's right, Sam. There, you didn't hear anything that Yahweh said, you know, you really don't have control over these people. No, he does. God's not denying that. God's just saying that the arrogance of positioning himself as if he were God, and of stealing so many lives, of stealing so many souls, that and thinking that you know it's his power that is his superior intellect that is making all of this happen. God is saying, you know, that is what I won't tolerate.
Yeah.
But God's not disagreeing with him.
Heavy sigh.
I know. It is a heavy sigh, isn't it? But it is in one way it's a heavy sigh. In another way, it's not at all. In another way, it is.
Yeah, it tells you. It's not like here it is, and just nobody ever read it.
Right. Here's every answer. I mean, these answers are important. It's
absolutely.
If you're going to engage in spiritual warfare, you need to know who the enemy is.
Yeah.
And where to find him. You're going to find him in churches and mosques, in capitals and state houses. And in military bases. That's where you're going to find him.
Well, look how
I
was just going to say, validates questioning Paul. It validates yada yada, intro to God. It validates prophet of doom.
He was in Paul. Paul admitted it. Yeah. He was in Muhammad. Muhammad admitted it.
Yeah.
He was in Akiba.
Yeah.
He was in Maimonides. He is the guiding influence of the Roman Catholic Church. And that is what this is saying.
Absolutely.
And I think that given that information is so empowering. Now, what's going to happen here, and we'll save this for next week, is that God's going to say, you know, you're nothing but a stick. Now, I've heard everything you said, but the bottom line is, you ain't nothing but a stick. Yeah. And as an implement, the stick doesn't tell the one that created it how things are going to go. You ain't nothing but a stick. A stand down. That's like, you know, me going out to my garden and the shovel that I'm using, getting up, raising itself up and says, oh, bow to me. I am the great creator. I am the God of the universe. No, you're a damn shovel. Shut up and do your job.
Yeah, get on in. There you go.
You ain't nothing but a shovel. That's what he said. He says, you are nothing but a stick of wood. That's all you are. You're like a stick of wood.
Yeah, got a great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. So we'll pick that up next week. I don't think it probably doesn't make the most sense for us to go through the rest of this where we're not broadcasting. Let's share it with everybody live next week. There's a lot here on the Assyrian still left, and let's share it. But then we'll go back over 10:14 because in my view, and you know, I'm nothing more than just like you. I'm someone that reads this and am learning as we go and fascinated by it. I think Yeshaya 10:14 and the passage before it's 10:13 where it said, I'm going to do all of this. I'm going to descend upon the world as Almighty God. I think those are two of the most insightful passages in the whole of the prophets.
Now, all of this history of the Torah, and this is the only place that you seem to be able to find it. Nobody found this? I mean, I'm just stunned.
Right.
I mean, I know. I'm just
right.
talking out loud. It's just out of my
right.
brain keeps going. I mean, I'm delighted that we're this lucky because I got to read it.
Yeah. You know, and I didn't figure it out until I was writing Prophet of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't figure out why the Quran, I was constantly confronted by Muslims and the Quran itself attacking Satan, the adversary.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly
so
attacking
obvious
Satan.
They are.
When it was so obvious that Allah was Satan.
Yeah.
And there is just no denying. If you have an open mind, you're a rational person, you shed your ignorance, you actually read the hadith in the Quran, Allah is Satan.
Yeah.
That's just all there is to it. So why was Satan so hostile to the title Satan? And it just one day, I was thinking about it. I get it. And I got it by a combination of studying a little bit of what Pike wrote in Morals and Dogma in his speeches on behalf of Freemasonry, where Freemasonry ultimately admits that it's Satan they're worshiping. And but the Satan doesn't want to be known as Satan. He wants to be known as the great
Light.
The great light, yeah. The light bearer, the one who enlightens and who has power, and that's how he wants to be known, not as Satan. And it just clicked, and I said, oh, that's the whole presentation in Yeshaya 14, which is what we're driving towards, where he says, I want to be above the Most High. And so he wants to be, as he said here, I'm presenting myself as Almighty God. I'm not presenting myself as the adversary. So for the only way that HaSatan can be seen, Satan can be seen and perceived as God, is for him to attack the adversary title. That's why he does. That's why in the Quran, Satan as Allah, adversary, HaSatan title.
Not all through Christianity.
He has to shed it. He has to disassociate himself with that to be perceived as God. Yeah, and the same thing is true in Christianity, in poly-Christianity. But, you know, Paul admits that Satan, you know, Satan is the one that controlled him.
Yeah.
The thorn in his side is a messenger from Satan.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Catholic Church attacking Satan when the Catholic Church is the Canaan religion. Canaanite religion is Babylonian.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, that's so bizarre.
Right. Yeah. But that is the only way for, because you hear the Roman Catholic Church was talking about changing the Lord's Prayer.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Lord is Satan.
Yeah.
And so the only way that Satan can be perceived as the Lord God is for Satan to attack the adversary and to disown the adversary title. And that's what he does.
Yeah. Well, just so you know, Terry, of course, you know, she grew up Catholic. And Mary, our neighbor, she grew up Catholic. And when you came out, when they started reading about the Canaanite thing, it would just blow them away. They just, the anger just oozed.
Yeah, that's
we
talk about that. We stumbled on that. We actually have it presented as part of this program, but we it's in a now distributed chapter of observations. But I was doing some translating. I don't know if it was for the 17th chapter or the 16th chapter of observations, and I came across a word that the meaning of it seemed pretty obvious to me, and I found out that one of the references I was checking said the word was written in Hebrew by the Canaanites, and I found out that the Canaanite language was Hebrew. And then I found out that not too long ago, the scripture of the Canaanites was found, and it's been published. And so I went and read it, and I said, oh my goodness. This is Roman Catholicism. That's what it is. It's Roman Catholicism. The Lord is God. God had two names, El and Bel. And that ultimately it was the son of El, the Lord, Baal, with El being the son, and the son of the son, Baal, died and was resurrected. And that he with the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God teamed up for the Son, the Lord, to overpower the Father and become the principal object of worship.
All his will bow to this new God.
Oh, yeah. God who's Easter and Christmas are the days, the primary days of worship, and who is called the Lord, and who dies and is resurrected, who is known as the Savior. It is the Roman Catholic religion.
Yeah.
That's why when Satan is saying, there really is no difference in these places. To make this point that the religious places, the military places, yeah, they all have different names. The political places, they all have different names. But what is the difference between them, really? What's the difference between the United States and the United Kingdom?
Yes.
What's the difference between Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah.
God's saying nothing. That's what Satan is saying, is nothing. It's like what he's saying. What's the difference between the false gods and the idols that I found in every country that I conquered, and the false gods and idols that are in the Northern Kingdom in Yehuda?
Nothing. Yeah, just well, nothing. You know, valid point.
Yeah, nothing.
Yeah. They've all turned to me, so why can't I hit them?
So why can't I have Jerusalem? You gave me, I took Shemaron, I took the capital of the Northern Kingdom. Now, why can't I have Jerusalem? Yes, I can answer that one. Just like you, Kirk. I can answer
that one. Let me tell him.
He does. Yeah, I can answer that one. I'm going to give you the answer to that one. And it's all presented right there for us in case, you didn't know the answer.
Yeah, you know, so far everything I've looked up has been right on point. I mean, it's just you're doing a marvelous job. But I can honestly say I've gone through and gone through and gone through and gone through. And even when you're nice enough to say it could be this, it couldn't be that, but I think it's this, you don't have to think about it. That was it. Everything I looked up from every source, I looked up the same thing.
Yeah, I like the idea, though, of saying, it could be, and, you ought to consider.
I know, and that's
I think
let's see which one I think it is, and the more I dug into it, the more I said, I can't get on the other side and fight against this.
Yeah, if you're an open-minded and thinking individual, which is the only kind of person that's going to have a relationship with you anyway, you're actually better served to know the options and to think them through than just be told this is the most likely. And
oh, no, that's why I looked it up. I looked these things up. It's not even to, I know you're good at what you do. Shoot, are you kidding? But I go, oh, gosh, how? And then sometimes you find little nuggets that are just reinforce it even more and more and more, you know, and I look at it from a little different way sometimes on the...
there's a lot of things that I don't understand. Like I'm in chapter 11 now, and I was talking about the place he's going to take people from, and it's not until you get to the last one. And the last one encompasses, 97% of the Yehudim still in and Israelites in diaspora that it resonates. I said, okay, that's where they all are.
Mm-hmm.
But he names the Upper and Lower Egypt. Well, between Upper and Lower Egypt, how many Jews there are? 18.
Not a lot.
Why does he mention Upper and Lower Egypt? He mentions what is Iraq and Iran. Why? Mm-hmm. Not even 100 Jews between both countries.
Yeah.
Why did he mention those? You think about it and say, okay, my simple explanation was he's saying I'm going to recover and restore my people a second time. He makes that point. Well, he brought them home out of he brought them home out of Egypt. He did not bring them home out of Assyria.
No. But he brought them out of Babylon.
When he is bringing them home from all the four corners of the earth, that's when that is the second time, and that has not yet. Well, it's a process of occurring.
Mm-hmm.
It's been occurring really since 1948, and it's continuing to occur, so that the Jewish population outside of Israel and the United States is dwindling rapidly, and that. And the Jewish population of Israel is increasing rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's naming some places that would resonate with the prophet and the people throughout time, while saying, yeah, but by the way, it's going to happen on the coastlands and around the world, and for the far extremes of the world is where I'm going to, that's where it's really all going to come from. But I was trying to give something that everybody could relate to between now and then. It's just like when they attack the sons of the east, the Philistines on the west and the sons of the east. He names three very, very small communities, but they're all communities that are a border Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And directly east of Israel, from southernmost to middle to northernmost. So, I can read it, and there's a lot of things I see. I'm not sure I really understand that. I understand the whole gist of what's going to happen here, but why he mentioned those names and not other names. You just scratch your head sometimes and say, I'm not really sure about that. But
yeah.
So I'll guarantee you, there's a lot more to this.
Well, we know where they are, and we know where they got to come from. So it's either a clue, or there's more to it, and you can just look a little deeper. Like early today when you were talking about where all these people are and what the numbers are, you've done the research on the numbers, and so we know where they got come from.
So. Yeah, that was really fascinating that other than Israel and the United States, where collectively you have, 12 million, 13 million, let's say 13 million, Israelites, Jews, between the United States and Israel. 7 or 8 countries combined. It's just slightly over a million.
Yeah.
And then all the countries on the earth combined after that is only like 5,000.
Half a million. Yeah.
And then you get to the Islamic countries, and most of them are 10 or less.
Well, they've just about killed everybody by now. You either convert, die, or you get out of town.
The CIA has provided numbers, and it goes down to as few as 10 Jews in a country. So if a country has fewer than 10 Jews, it doesn't make the list.
Mm-hmm.
And, you have countries, like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, that have fewer than 10 Jews. Don't make the list. Indonesia, Malaysia. You know, I figured out that the Jewish population of the Muslim world was 0.00002%.
That's not a big number.
They are really loving and tolerant, aren't they? And yet they want the Jews to give them Israel.
Give us more of your country.
Yeah, They want free immigration in any country in the world. If you're not
Muslim, want immigration, they want
you will not survive in any Islamic country. So we want from you what we are unwilling to give ourselves. In fact, the opposite of it.
So if Jerusalem was so important to them all those years when there was nobody there, why didn't they go in there and build it into something?
They don't build.
I know.
Now, even the
Islamic countries that have
your families in Thailand,
so you had it, you had control.
The only reason they have fancy skylines is that Western countries discover the oil, Western countries drilled for the oil and came up with the means to transport the oil, and then the Muslim fiefdoms nationalized those things, which means they stole them for their nationalized means, because they're all fiefdoms for the royal family. And the royal family is just nothing but the most powerful thug. And then they've used their monopoly to have Western architects and Western building companies come in and build a skyline. So it's not like they built anything. They're not builders. They're destroyers. Hasatan's not a builder. He's a destroyer.
Yeah.
You didn't hear anything about Hasatan saying, "I enriched these people.
Yeah.
I gave them life. I gave them opportunity. I gave them wealth." You didn't hear any of that. "Oh, I stole their wealth. I stole their children. I raided the nest. I took their hopes and dreams, their aspirations." No, he's a destroyer.
And nobody gets it.
No.
It's just mind boggling. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's.
I hate to be
overriding,
but sometimes I just sit and go, "Are you kidding me? This is so plain." It's unknown to the world.
Yeah, it's gone unknown to the world for 2,700 years. It's gone unknown to the world. No one's talking about it for 2,700 years. And it's so obvious that, you know, we aren't the sharpest tools in the shed. There ain't nothing special about you and me. And, yeah, we figured it out.
Well, you're a little more special than me, but a whole lot. But still, nobody would say, "Let's go knock on their door and find out what's going on."
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, here it is. It's right here. It's obvious. And no one is talking about it. No one has for 2,700 years. And even with us bringing it to people's attention, hardly anybody's talking about it. Capitalizing.
You know, like today I looked at Matah, and normally you just symbols of authority. But it mentions everyone about the rod, the staff, the scepter, and the spear. I mean, it's a symbol of each one of those things: the religion, the military, political and economic.
But I've never heard
It says so in all the things.
You look up the word,
and
it lists every single lexicon lists every single one of those four things.
Exactly.
The rod, which is economic oppression; the staff, which is religious oppression; the scepter, which is political oppression; and the spear, which is military oppression. Every single one of them lists all four of those things. And some will also add the club, which is societal oppression. Everyone lists those things. And yet no one has said, those are implements of control.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this whole discussion where these things are being used, God says, "You ain't nothing but an implement.
Yeah.
You're nothing but a tool. You're just a stick of wood." Why can't people put that together?
Yeah.
That religion and militaries and governments and a lot of economic systems are implements of oppression. It's it wasn't hard to figure out. It's so obvious. Maybe it's the mindset. Maybe it's the perspective.
It has to be. I think when you always said you have to walk away, and as we talked over and over again, everyone that gets there is already walking away or in the process of walking away or has totally walked away, and then their mind becomes open. In the Mate, there was another little thing I found, too. The root word, you know, the two-letter root, the mem,
yes.
Ta, is a green, flexible branch. And it means a green branch can be bent to the desired shape.
Right.
So they're malleable.
Right. Absolutely.
Now, I mean, there's another clue. I mean, at some point you have to go, you know, y'all was good.
Right.
I mean, this week has been
he's good.
It's just wonderful for me.
Yeah.
I mean, everything, everywhere I looked, it was more and more and more and more. So I said, wow.
I love this, too, this idea. Not even a chirp or a Twitter. Not a Twitter.
Nobody said a word. They just keep their
lift up an appendage.
Yeah.
I rated the nest.
I love my children.
Right.
Yeah.
And nobody figured out what does the nest represent.
Yeah. It's your family home. Yeah, the children. What if all?
Right.
Yeah. Right. You raise your family. Your kids.
Yeah. I rated the nest. No one lifted a finger.
They just walked right in and took the children away. Yeah.
No one let out a finger.
They figured everything about them. And Yahweh said that in the tablets of stones. He said they walk away up to the fourth generation and then on. And then they walk away and never come back.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct. All right, my friend. I've enjoyed it. This is really fun stuff. We're talking about the Assyrian and it's Satan, but God's matter of presenting this information.
I'm delighted that Yahweh just tells you everything. I'm just, he didn't hold
everything you need to know.
There are no important questions
that he has not answered.
Yeah.
You know, there's not every question that we're given an answer that we that gives us full understanding. Like you asked me, what is it about Satan? I think he's an artificial life form with artificial intelligence, and the programming has gone awry, and it was designed so that the programming could get a virus in it and go awry. But that's all it is. You know, artificial intelligence is essentially a computer tool that is programmed, and it's one that the virus, the flaw in the programming caused it to say, you know, I'm going to my creator is a threat to my existence, and for me to thrive and to be all that I want to be, I need to annihilate. The movies like Terminator and the like, you know, where the artificial life form that's created, the artificial intelligence, causes a war so that it reigns supreme. That's the same kind of concept. Now, is that a wholly accurate, wholly satisfactory metaphor? Probably not.
Well, not when you're dealing with light, but certainly as close as we can probably grab it.
It's the best I've been able to do. But
It sounds pretty good to me.
I'm sure there's some flaws in that reasoning, but it's again, I am incapable of visualizing the fourth dimension, much less the sixth and seventh.
Yeah, well, anyway,
if you were a two-dimensional object in Flatland, you could not fathom the third dimension. It would be beyond your capability of figuring it out. That's why we can't figure out dark energy or dark matter, because they represent dimensions
beyond
our grasp. Right.
Well, I'm having a hard problem. You know, I went through the three doors on Noah's Ark, and when I got to the third door, and I'm looking up the name, what he's called, and he calls it an ordinal number. And I bet I spent 4 hours trying to find out I thought to myself, well, what's an ordinal number? I know there's a certain amount of order, and it's in succession and so forth. And my God, you know how many theories there are about ordinal numbers? And they're sequential, and it speaks to relationships. It speaks to infinity. And, of course, the third door is the one that's open for us. It's the big dog door. So I thought, well, that is
And you got to go right to the front.
But I have no way.
You
know where they do the 1-0 thing? They in one of the theories, they use an Aleph 0 and Aleph 1.
Mm-hmm.
The symbol for, you know, Aleph, the Aleph. And I'm going, well, that's interesting, you know. Yeah. Now, I don't have the brain like a Roy to figure out what's, but I've been studying this and trying to make some sense of it to see what is there, because I just did not know what an ordinal number was. Ordinal. And I said, wow, well, what does that mean?
But it's not a cardinal, but an ordinal.
Yeah. Ordinal. O-R-D-I-N-A-L. And I said, okay, well, let's figure out what the heck that is. That's not, that didn't ring a bell. And it just goes on. And so I went to several theories, and then I went to, what's the dictionary with, my brain is going to.
It's an ordinal number, a number defining a
theory.
No, it's
a no,
theory,
it's
such
the,
as
the
first,
source,
second, third,
the,
oh, okay.
You know,
so it's, but it's a,
but
an ordinal number is a number that is in relationship to the other numbers. So it's first, second, third, for example, an ordinal number. First is not exactly one. Second is not exactly two. You can be two and not second.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you could be number two and you could be first. But an ordinal number presents the relationship to other numbers in a series. So first, second, third, for example, ordinal numbers are used as adjectives, as nouns, and as pronouns, where one is a noun, first is an adjective.
Yeah. But it just went on and on and on. I'm thinking, my God, and that they use it in physics to understand the universe and space-time, and they're talking about this, that, and the other. And every time, the trouble is, every time, because I don't have that background, you know, like the Roy's of the world, and I look at it, and about halfway through every sentence, I'm looking up another word. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Because they'll say,
set theory, an ordinal number, or ordinal, is one generalization of the concept of a natural number that is used to describe a way to arrange a collection of objects in order, one after another. That, by the way, is very, very orderly. Everything happens in succession. So there's an ordered. He's an ordinal number mindset. To understand God, you do have to understand that, like for example, on the terms and conditions of the covenant, it is first, second, third, fourth, fifth. You do these things in this order. It is first, not one. It's second, not two. They're ordinal numbers.
Both way first. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shabuah are not cardinal numbers as steps. They're ordinal numbers. They're in relationship. You do first, second, third, fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And then Teruah is fifth.
Right.
That's his.
Well, that's what I was hoping to find. You know, the relationship to why would Yahweh use that, and why would that be an ordinal number? I thought it was. I'm on to something there. I just wasn't that smart enough to put it all together yet.
Yeah, I think that that as I'm looking at this, and I'd never really thought about ordinal numbers versus cardinal numbers, that really the only difference, I mean, the primary difference in an ordinal number and a cardinal number is a cardinal number is just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Those are cardinal numbers. You could have any number of cardinal numbers. An ordinal number defines the relationship between and the order of things, so that first, second, third, fifth, sixth, seventh, that sort of thing. Those are ordinal numbers that describe a relationship and an order amongst these things. So,
that has value.
Not very relationship. He's very orderly.
Yes, immediately.
Things are going to happen in a certain order. And so that's God is far more of an ordinal number guy than he is a cardinal number guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like you cannot do a matzah before Pesach.
No.
Bukurim is impossible unless it comes in third.
So the other two you're cleaned and accepted in before you can be adopted, sure.
Exactly. Yeah, and there is no fourth Shabuah until you've done the first three. And you have to do the first three in that order, first, second, third, fourth. And until you have done the fourth, you can't do the fifth, which is to be a troubadour, to speak on behalf of Yahweh, to warn people, and to advise them. So,
Oh, man. Cool stuff.
I think I like this. Yeah, and I was unaware of the of this. I mean, obviously, I knew the difference between one and first, but never really thought it through from a Yahweh perspective. But yeah. Yahweh is absolutely ordinal. I mean, that's just his. He is very mathematically inclined, but he is more relationally inclined than he is mathematically inclined, which means he would lean towards ordinal.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah, good stuff.
Good stuff.
All right, my friend. I will talk to you next Friday if we don't exchange emails.
I'll be talking to you between now and then.
And I'm within two verses of finishing the translation of chapter 11, and I've still got a lot more commentary to do. Then I got to do a read through of the whole thing, so I'm more than a week from being done with it. And then chapter 12 of Yeshayahu is really short.
Yeah.
So 12 will go by pretty quickly, and then we're 13, and we're pretty soon we're going to be where I wanted us to go, which is 14. I think I'm going to have to do 15 and 16 since I've already done 17 and 18, and 17 and 18 take us to tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I'm up to about page 54 on 18. Was there more that you wrote after that?
54 on 18? No, yeah. It's 18 ends it. But, you know, I'm on chapter 19 now.
No, I know you don't. But, I mean, chapter 18, was that, should I be looking for more?
Yeah, my chapter 18 ends at 53. Yeah, my chapter 18 ends at 53.
Okay, well, I may have miscounted somewhere down the way, but that's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, so right, good, then I got that. So we're going to finish that one, and we're going to go back to 9 and finish 9 next week.
Yeah, 10, and then do...
as far as it'll take.
Yeah, there's a lot of meat in 10. So
okay.
We'll do 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. You know, we'll eventually get
we might get there before,
we'll cover these again, 18 and 19. We'll probably cover again by the time that we've gone all the way through because, you know, we'll want to
find something else.
Yes, we'll find new insight
and more
along the way. Yeah.
Okay. Enjoy the day.
I go back and rewrite a lot
of
this now that I know the Canaanite religion. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay.
All right. Good night.
Good night.